So yes, I'm here to talk about decision-making and intimate partner violence in the context of married couples in India. And a quick background, I know some of this has already been discussed before in terms of IPV and definitions and also something other stuff related to the data set, so I'll kind of skip over those a little bit. But I basically focused on the WHO definition of intimate partner violence, or IPV, which is including the physical, psychological, or emotional, and sexual violence that women occur. And this is in the context of women as victims. Global estimates range from 10 to 70% from numerous studies, population-based studies, et cetera. And in the Indian context, it tends to kind of go between 20 to 50%. So it's a high prevalence, serious issue there. And just a little background. Gender-based violence, of course, and violence against women is so complex and multifaceted, but it seems, you know, the literature is supporting that it's really rooted in gender inequality. Okay, it is a cause and a consequence, so it's very complex to try to address that. So one way to possibly deal with inequality is looking at gender norms. And in the context of India, especially in marital context, traditional norms of ideal masculinity, ideal femininity, those are the things that tend to influence domestic violence. And there's kind of two big things discussed in the literature. One, the transgression of normative behaviors and the roles for women, and if those are transgressed, then possibly violence can ensue. And then the flip for the male perpetrators is also in from the literature is frustration for not fulfilling certain ideals of what's considered an ideal husband or protector of the family, provider, and so on. So both of those, unfortunately, resulting sometimes in partner violence. So this study wanted to look at empowerment. There's a lot of issue, there's a lot of discourse with empowerment in the literature with women's health and development, and definitely with partner violence. And there's lots of different perspectives and definitions. So this study focuses on, I think, Kabir's definition, which is a women's empowerment is a process by which those who are denied the ability to make strategic life choices gain access to and control of these three areas: resources, agency, and achievements. Okay, and you can see, you know, the resources would be, say, the financial aspect, income, education, so the microloan things, programs, improving women's education, agency, which is what I'll be talking about, decision-making, okay, there's definitely other aspects of that, and achievements. And the achievements could be improved health outcomes for the woman, family, children, also not being a victim of violence. So again, the study looks at empowerment as a predictor for intimate partner violence, looking at those three main areas. The larger study, this is part of my dissertation from several years back, also looks at attitudes towards gender norms, so what I refer to as gendered ideology. And it also includes men's perspectives, because as we've been hearing, they're important. They're part of this. So the study kind of looked at their responses to decision making, to gendered ideology, aside from the demographic characteristics that I think we think of alcohol use or controlling behaviors. And then this study also looked at the dynamics between the two, between the husband's perspective and the wife's perspectives, and kind of the dynamics between the two in terms of agreement or interpretation and things like that. But those aspects I won't get into for this day. I won't go into the conceptual model, but it's just to acknowledge that this is a larger larger powers happening. There's societal gender inequality, community level factors, and so on, household, women. And again, I focus on just the kind of the colored aspects, which is the demographics and then men and women. Okay, so it's a DHS survey. I think we're pretty familiar with the demographic health surveys from India. This is the third wave from the National Family Health Survey in India, conducted in 2005 and 2006. All the stuff we've heard before, it's nationally representative, stratified, clustered, sample weights. It's a large data set, obviously coming from India, 124,000 women, 74,000 men, and based on the questionnaires, they were able to form a matched couples data set, which is really unique and was a great resource and strength of this study. The analytical sample then was valid responses only, 23,000 couples. Okay, so the dependent variable was lifetime experience with intimate partner violence. And the focus was on 12 original questions. Emotional, physical, and sexual violence were addressed. And basically, it's collapsed for this study, into a binary outcome. Okay, if the woman had experienced any one of the 12 different types of violence listed, then she was considered experiencing a form of partner violence. And then in terms of the independent variable, I mentioned women's empowerment was the main predictor looked at. And I'm sure we're all familiar with issues about women empowerment in terms of the measurement, how do you measure it, how do you define it, and it's so diverse. And the literature tends to look at it as both a process, okay, which is also very difficult to measure, and also as an outcome. So I try to, as best as possible, look at both of those wherever I could combine, but mostly it's looked at, since this is a cross-sectional survey, as empowerment as a static state, as a given point of time, measured by proxy indicators. And that's typically what's done with empowerment, right, to capture agency and power. Okay, so there's several areas of empowerment that were examined, but the ones that addressed personal power, so women's personal power, were those two that covered access to resources, gendered ideology, and decision-making agency. Okay, so in terms of decision-making, there's two domains. There's household decisions and financial decisions. So in terms of the household decision-making, both spouses were asked, this is the original question, who usually decides the following decisions? Mainly you, mainly your husband, you and your husband jointly, or someone else? Okay, and there was three items on that. Major household purchases, making purchases for daily household needs, and then decisions about family and relatives. Now, I do want to say there were additional questions asked to women, and then there were additional questions asked to the men, but since I was looking at it from a couple's perspective, we focused on only these three that were asked of both spouses. Okay, and then again, measurement issues. When you're looking at decision making, how are you going to include this? Well, there's numerous different ways to include decision making and how to measure it. And interestingly, the literature had about 5 to 6 different options, and we kind of went through that and to see which would be the best option. And for this study, we ended up going with the number of sole decisions, okay, made by the wife alone. And this would be, we're looking at women's perspective. So how many decisions she felt were made alone by her, the wife alone, how many were made by the husband alone, and then how many she felt they made jointly. Okay. And then in terms of the financial decision-making, there were two original questions. Who decides how the money you earn will be used, so that's the wife's earnings, and then who decides how your husband's earnings will be used. And again, similar responses, the respondent, husband, jointly, someone else, or if there were no earnings involved. So just some quick results. About 38% of the women in this sample experienced partner violence, and you can see that the majority of that is physical violence. But there is a significant, there is some emotional and definite sexual violence occurring. In terms of just the demographic characteristics, I won't go into detail with this, but 44% of the women had no education. Okay. Of the women who did have some education, the mean education was middle school, about middle school level, which was 8.4 years. And then also another important factor was that one quarter experienced violence as children. I'm going to, let's see, this is just some descriptive statistics, frequencies of the gendered ideology. If you see how many women, 77% support women's ability to refuse marital sex. However, only 44% of the women supported justifying partner violence. So, 44% did not justify partner violence. Okay, so there's some issues with gendered ideology there. Okay, in terms of decision making, 66% of the women perceived they did not make any household decisions. Okay, I know it might be kind of hard to see at the bottom, but it's hard to understand from just the descriptive statistics, but the women tended to say that there were more joint decisions occurring. So they didn't attribute sole decision-making to themselves. Okay, and then interestingly, for financial decisions, almost 65% of women felt they made joint decisions regarding the husband's earnings. And it was primarily the husband's earnings that we kind of looked at, because over 70% of the women didn't have their own earnings. But interestingly, even of those women who had their own earnings, the majority of them, 17%, felt that the decisions were jointly made. Okay, so there were several models built. This is actually the unadjusted model. The first unadjusted model was with just the personal power characteristics and domestic violence. And here we see that having a bank account, these are the other aspects that were included, and the gendered ideology were protective for having positive gendered ideology, were protective for women in terms of not experiencing domestic violence. For decision making, interestingly, the more decisions women made alone was indicative of experiencing partner violence. For financial decision making, however, the joint decision making was protective for women. Okay. As mentioned, there are several models built. The final model included sociodemographic characteristics as well as husband's perspectives, and so that's model four, where the partner's included. So in this adjusted model, we see that the gendered ideology, which is not supporting partner violence and supporting the ability to refuse sex, were very protective for women to not experience violence. And household decision-making no longer was related. However, financial decision-making still held, and it was protective. If women perceived they made joint decisions with their husband about his earnings, family earnings, then they were less likely to experience violence. So those are the two key things: gendered ideology, financial decision-making. The main thing to kind of address in here would be the issue of gender norms. Again, even though in the unadjusted model, household decision making was significant, we have to see that why is that? That perhaps it's the transgressing of gender roles, and that empowerment might be seen from a Western perspective, or we're encouraging women to make soul decisions. But in the Indian context, perhaps it's more productive for them to have joint decisions, and we see that with the financial decision making. The limitations, again, temporal sequence, cross-sectional data, the use of proxies, because these are abstract terms, not really being able to capture empowerment, agency. You know, there might be agency in women choosing to not make a sole decision, but how do we capture that? So these are some limitations with that. For the future, measurement. I'm a big methodologist, and I always think about how do we do this. And interestingly, I ran all of these different decision-making items, and they all had different results. So it's something I think we need to continue to look at, looking at gender norms and actual scales that measure gender norms and gender equitable men or sexual relationship power. And then, as mentioned earlier, involving men. I think transforming the gender norms, addressing gender inequality is critical, and it has to involve men and boys to change that and to focus on gender equity not being this zero-sum game, which, you know, and definitely in the Indian context is viewed as that. So that's it. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. It's really very interesting, and I think on this panel we looked at different aspects of why it's important, and the underlying commonality is women's health is definitely, it's like a 3D puzzle because it has so many factors influencing it. So could you please join me in giving our presenters a round of applause, and thank you so much, that was really good. And now I'd like to open the floor for discussion. And if there's a question you would, and I would request the panelists to come up here because I think it's easier for you to see who's asking you questions. And if you have a question directed at a particular panelist, please address that. If not, you know, whoever will answer it is, do we need another chair?
Do we
need one more? Yeah. Come on, please.
Pull one.
No, I think we need one more for you.
That's all right.
No. I mean, this is reverse.
No
we don't want to do that.
Go ahead.
I mean, like, you're like the icing on the cake. There's so many people.
Go ahead.
Yeah.
I feel lucky.
Okay. So, does anybody have any questions? Yes, could you first please identify yourself? First you, then you, and then you. Yes.
Hi, I'm Julia Corbello, New York City.
Yay, go New York.
I'm from.
I know, that's what I'm saying. I'm from New York too, so.
Well, by the treatment, you know, actual the treatment of the cancer has to, you know, pretty much it's restricted to Amman, and it really is the King Hussein Cancer Center, and as I mentioned, the King Abdullah Hospital, which are really the treatment centers for cancer. Fortunately, those are outstanding treatment centers. I mean, the King Hussein Cancer Center is just absolutely top notch, really working toward a world class standard of care for cancer. The advantage, Jordan, is in that respect, it is, as I mentioned, a relatively small country of 6 million people. So in that respect, I think they are enabled to handle the cases that they get. The key is, of course, we may create that monster where, you know, that we create so much, you know, awareness of this that, you know, maybe they will reach a capacity level and have to expand that. But I think Jordan is well positioned. The medical infrastructure in Jordan is actually, they are in fact promoting medical tourism in Jordan. It's a destination now, particularly within the region. You had, even with Arab Spring and the like, people coming in for medical care from Libya, even, for example, to seek medical care in Jordan. So I think that Jordan's well positioned to address treatment. And the key thing is just really just promoting that awareness of just early detection. That's what we have to get out there. Now mammography is something that we have to address. That's probably a dearth of those services, and that is something that they are trying to address. You know, they have this mobile van that goes around, but you know, I think continued training of technicians and creation of mammogram facilities is something that, in fact, my project now, even though it's family planning, we're going to work with a partner to try to generate some funding, not USA, because we're restricted on how we can use our funds, but we're working with the Family Planning Association, the Planned Parenthood, if you like, of Jordan, to set up mammogram facilities within their clinics, or at least a few of them, as a test to see if they can sustain that. The key, of course, is you know, getting the funding for it and then charging fees that they were able to sustain that type of service, but we do want to get them involved. So I think this is something that's going to evolve over time.
Thank you so much. And just to add on to that, actually, I had the opportunity of working in the Middle East many years ago, and the amount they spend on healthcare and hospitals is really outstanding. I mean, like, you could get even a script for antibiotics filled free of cost at the hospital pharmacy. So I think that's one thing, is the way they realize the importance of health and are, you know, putting their resources there. And I think we had our next question here. I think you were next, and then you were third. Yes, go ahead, please. And could you please identify yourself?
No, I'm not saying that. Let me answer the second question first. No, I'm not saying at all that it's predominantly a Muslim practice. In fact, that when you look at literature regarding FGM, it's not associated with religious practices at all. It's just that within Mali, that it's predominantly a Muslim nation. So
women who experience it
were just predominantly Muslim. So we just looked at religion as a variable, because within multiple studies that's been considered an important factor to look at, but it wasn't saying that it's predominantly a Muslim practice. And the other thing, I think I didn't describe it very well, but within DHS, they do look, it's a nationally representative sample, so they look at rural and urban tracts within the country. So the data looked at equally at rural and urban segments of the population. So we didn't look at whether it was more predominant within rural versus urban. No.
Thank you. And our next guest, and I think we have only time for one question, because then people will have to go for other talks. Yes, go ahead. Could you please identify yourself?
Oh, my name is Chioma Anagwong, and I am living in Chicago, MBA student. Just a question about the methodology with the data collection. Were you surveyed, or were it interviews that were
face-to-face interviews?
And with the questions that were asked, the couples jointly, were the couples together in those situations, mm-hmm. or were they asked separately about joint?
No, they were separate. They were not, and there was some methodology to ensure that the woman was alone, or you know the husband knew, but to ensure privacy, openness of the response, and likewise for the male as well.
Thank you. One last question. Does anybody have one last question? Go ahead.
And I was wondering, why is that?
any effect on peri or postpartum depression as we
looked into that? That's a really interesting question, and no, we didn't actually look at that. That was not one of the variables that we were looking at in our evaluations. But it's a good idea to look at that in the future. And there is growing evidence that that's, you know, a very important factor in fetal development and in child growth, also the stress levels of the mother. So I think that's a very relevant question. Thank you.
Thank you so much, everybody, and thank you. And have a good flight and happy Halloween, and there's candy here.